Morning, and
we've got Kai Cook from University of Utah.
Number six.
Well, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to report on our MPOC Enhanced Observational Study. This was a study which there was a call, I think in late 2016, asked, well, so we're collecting all this electronic data. What if we could enhance this with manual, non-electronic observations? And so a number of proposals were made, and we got together with Michigan and Virginia and proposed a study looking at post-operative pain profiles, analgesic use, and then trying to figure out what does that have to do with transition to chronic pain and excessive and prolonged opioid use patterns. We had about 12 participating sites. You can see them here, and there were three aims. I'm rushing through this. We have more slides, and I have time. So the first aim was really a historical view based on electronic data. How was intraoperative pain management done, and has that changed over the last 4 or 5 years? And then aim two and aim three had to do with enhanced observational piece, where we were surveying patients, and then preoperatively, and also follow up at 1 month and 3 months, and then finally aim three to look at, okay, what were some of the factors? And let me just share with you some of the early data and the early analysis that are now coming together. Most of the analysis has been done by Nathan Pace, actually. And if you have in-depth statistical questions, I'm going to refer to him. So for the historical view, we start with about 9 million cases that are in MPOC. We exclude patients below 18 years. Surgery range was from between 2012 and 2016. That gets us to about 4.6 million cases. We remove cases that have missing values on the surgery type, on the oral morphine equivalent, on sex. We also excluded certain surgeries, minor surgeries, outpatient surgery, that kind of stuff. Gets us down to about 2.3 million cases. And then we only wanted to look at institutions that actually had consistently data within the time range that we were looking at. So total about 1.13 million cases. You know, starting at 9, ending at about a little bit over than 1 million doesn't sound that great, but 1.13 million cases, that's quite still a large number. So here are some of the demographic numbers. So age between 18 and 90, weight, we had about 45 to 54% male to female ratio. I want to point out also, this is a breakdown of the different races, and you can see already one issue with trying to analyze this, large imbalances of number of patients depending on the race. Oral morphine equivalents, we use those to then compare the different cases, and on the left side you see the absolute dose, and you have a multimodal distribution, which is kind of interesting, showing you the preferred dosage size, and then when you divide that by the patient's weight, you can see more a continuous distribution, a little bit lopsided to the left. When we look at the intraoperative opioids broken down by race, you can see that you can't see much here. You can also see that there is, the area has to do, or the width of those buckets has to do, is related to the square root of how many patients are in that race. And it's really hard to see. So Nathan looked at different statistical ways of teasing the differences out better. And what he did was the linear multivariable regression, where he looked at all these different variables that you can see on the screen, and used a package that has been implemented in R and that implements a paper from the 1980s from Searle and others on marginal means. And when you apply this, for example, to the race, then you get a plot like this, where the blue bars are the traditional confidence interval that we know. You can see a little bit, it's kind of hard to see, but Hispanic white, for example, you can see this blue dot. So that's the traditional mean. And then the red arrows, those are really adjusted for the imbalance and sample size, and they're more for comparing the different groups with each other. And the idea is the more they overlap, the higher the p-value is. And so you can see here that, for example, our black patients get considerably less morphine equivalents than some of the other races, and you can see distinct differences. The Middle Eastern patients, they have a large overlap, so there's probably not much of a difference. You apply the same methods and modeling for men and women. You see men get more morphine and opioids than women do. I'm not a clinician, so I can't tell you whether that's clinically significant, but there seems to be a difference. If we look at the number of non-opioids administered intraoperatively over time, there's no change over the time range that we looked at. So it stays at one. So we're talking about multimodal pain therapy and maybe multiple different non-opioids given. That has not changed, apparently. The intraoperative use of opioids over time within the time range has gone down slightly. This is now in milligrams per kilogram. So you can see there's a slight difference. And each one of these buckets, that's why they have different sizes, represent about 50,000 cases. For AIM-2, the enhanced observational part, let me just remind you, this is kind of what we did. So we took the electronic data from the MPOC data. We had enhanced observations during patient enrollment, so in September of 2017. And then we had 1 week phone interviews a month later, and then another 1 week of phone interviews for the three-month follow-up. And we put them all together and hoping to tease out some of the risk factors that we were talking about. There were about, as I said, 12 participating sites, so we had a total of about 1,136 enrolled patients. There's an age range, a sex difference, and the ratio, and then we have ASA status, so most of our patients are with an ASA 2 and 3. During the pre-op interview, patients were asked to indicate where they have pain, where they had chronic pain, recurring, persistent, over the last 3 months, and we used this Michigan body map, and about one-third of the patients, two-thirds of the patients reported they had chronic pain. And then Nathan broke those many sites and distilled it down to just a few sites, and this is how they report it. This is now across all of our institutions, and it's kind of fascinating to me. Not much pain in the right arm, apparently, but more on the left. So I don't know what to think of that. You can break this down by institution, and that is a trend that continues there. If we're asking, so two-thirds have pain. About 44% on average are currently using pain medication, with about 2% of the cases didn't have had missing data. And you can see also a breakdown between the different institutions. They're anonymized here. How many are currently taking opioids? And there you see one of the challenges that we had in analysis. We had a few institutions where there was not much data, not much follow-up done or not entered into the system. But if you take the first seven that had marginal rates of missing data, about 70% of the patients are still taking opioids at 3 months. Interestingly to me, as a non-clinician, those patients who report no pain at their surgical site at 3 months, half of those are still taking opioids. This is kind of fascinating to me. Nathan put together a few probability density plots. So this is on the x-axis, you can see the age, and the green is taking opioids, and the red one is not taking opioids. A little bit lopsided, but seem to be lopsided in the same way. Similarly, if you look at it, okay, how much intra-op opioids did they get, and did that make a difference? If you squint your eyes a little bit, you can maybe see a difference, but it's hard to tell from this one. So in summary, just from this initial analysis of what have we learned, so there's a slight decrease in opioid use over the range of time that we looked at. There are differences, distinct differences by race. It seems to be that women get more opioids than men. The number of non-opioids used intraoperatively has not changed. It's one over the time range. About two-thirds of our patients come in with chronic pain, about 44% take pain medication, and at 70% There's still 70% of the patients are still taking opioids at 3 months, 50% even they don't have pain. Some of the next steps on AIM-1, we continue to look at trends over time by institution. And on the AIMS 2 and 3, one of the important tasks now ahead of us is to really identify which data is missing by institution so we can help the institutions identify where there's maybe gaps and maybe fill them in. And we also need to look more, and we're continuing analysis of the risk factors. We took some psychometric questions preoperatively, and we want to figure out what the risk factors were. Thank you very much.
I just had two questions, well, one comment and a question. So dovetailing off the talk this morning about the difference between weight-based dosing and absolute dosing. Yeah. So oftentimes people might use a round number when giving opioids in the OR, right, like fentanyl 50 mics, and if women tend to weigh less, mm-hmm, then that would skew their dose per weight to be higher. So just wondering if that might be part of it, if it's not a physiologic thing, but rather just average sizes of people. The second question I have is, how did you get the 3 month follow-up data? Are many MPOG centers reporting follow-up opioid use at 3 months?
Right, so this was, maybe the second question first. This was part of the enhanced observational piece. So they actually were dedicating, each of those participating institutions were dedicating part of their personnel to physically call these patients and ask a survey. It would be very nice if we could automate that, but it's not there, so that's where we did it here. For the first question, that's a great thought. We should look into that. I have to go back. I believe we reported those numbers by standardized by weight, but yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
So I have two questions. One, how do you square your data with the big observational studies that show, you know, somewhere shy of 10% are using opioids on an ongoing basis after surgery? Those are huge numbers. I mean, 50% of people who don't even have pain at the surgical site are still using them, right? 70% overall?
That's what it appears to be in the data.
So then that begs the question, and how are you going to get at why the people in your study are using opioids? You don't tell us anything about the amounts they're using at that point, just yes or no, right? It's just binary.
That's what this is. We were asking about the doses, but the quality of the data is not so that we can compare.
Well, did you ask them why they were using opioids?
There were a few questions in there. That's part of the analysis we're still needing to do. Yeah.
So what do you think? I mean, why are these patients using opioids at such an alarmingly high rate, if they don't have pain at the surgery?
Good question. We have a high number of missing data. It may be that the patients who did respond, they reported more. I don't know. Yeah. Any other thoughts, maybe from the clinical folks?
Well, remember that we selected for patients who had major surgeries. I don't know if your numbers are
different. Good point.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. It depends on what surgery you look at, but that's still an alarmingly high rate.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much. I think the main difference was probably these were major operations. This was the inclusion criteria were very specific for this study. Thank you so much, Kai.
Thank you.
Round of applause.